Okay, this is Cameron and Bob again. This is episode number 52, and we're starting at the top of page 103 of my book. But first, Cameron has a general thought he wants to bring in. So what was that, Cameron?
Well, we were talking about the McLuhan Research community, if you want to call it that. I was saying that it's more than a little ironic that there's almost no dialogue in that community. The people are supposedly researching McLuhan and keeping the McLuhan heritage alive, but absent dialogue, absent community exploration.
So yeah, now I get compliments all the time that what we do is the dialogue that people want to hear. And we know how to dialogue. We keep an even pace or even mood. We don't get ridiculous. We listen to each other. And there is underlying disagreements somewhere in there, but you might not even know what they are because we tend to find the same information around the same issues. So we agree in a lot of areas. So
but even where we disagree, it's not problematic.
Right.
Right. There's nothing wrong with disagreement as long as it's frankly acknowledged and discussed, and as long as there's an attempt to appreciate where the other person is coming from.
Yeah, now, I don't know if you just said it in this recorded part, but before you said for McLuhan, dialogue was everywhere. Is that what you said?
Everything. Everything.
Everything is dialogue. That includes talking to people that won't talk?
Yes, I mean, that's one of the peculiar things about dialogue as an ontological reality. If dialogue is fundamentally true, that is to say, if it's a fundamental part of the universe, then it would be contradictory to rule that certain things were outside of dialogue. So dialogue needs to always respect the inability of people or communities not to dialogue. And that's a very difficult thought to try to get around.
Yeah, to respect that people may not want to dialogue. Is that what you just
correct.
Said?
Or may not be able to.
Right. So, I've always tried to talk to everybody I met at the McLuhan scene, but basically I found that they didn't know much of what I was interested in, which was going back and reading a lot of his stuff and seeing the patterns way back then, how they shifted, what caused the shift, what possibly could have done it, what was he doing. And I didn't find anybody, so I had to go on the radio to talk to people, and nobody knew anything, so it didn't help much. I did have Nelson, who was reading stuff, and so he could give interesting responses. But once we all got on Facebook, well, we did, George Sanderson started the first one in 94, the first group talk. What do you call them? Usenet forum or something? What?
Mailing list, perhaps?
Yeah, mailing list. That's right, yeah. We were talking. Typing. And
George was a archetypal dialogist.
Yeah, and he was a teacher.
He had to be. Very easy to talk to, and he respected everybody.
Yeah, and he started the first forum as soon as it was before everybody got on the Internet in 95 with the Netscape and all that. Before that, 94, he started it. So that forum went on, but there was always people over-criticizing other people, like not liking them or making a problem. And I usually became a problem for some people at some point, but I always thought that was silly because I didn't like some of these people or what they were doing, but I didn't make an issue out of it. I would just talk to them anyways. I didn't say, okay, we're banning you. I never would support any banning unless someone was really ridiculous, like a psychopath or something. But we didn't have any of those in our group or community.
Sure.
So
Well, you take dialogue far more seriously than almost anybody else.
Right.
Because you say, somebody's dead? Well, all right, I can dialogue with that. Somebody's crazy? Okay, I can dialogue with that.
Yeah.
Right? The universe? Okay, I could dialogue
with that. The only guy I couldn't dialogue with back then, in 99, 2000, was you. Because you had this crazy idea that concept was perceptive, and you put everything in quotes. You were the hardest to respond to. I don't know if you remember my response to you, but I didn't respond much to what you were saying. But you were, I don't know if you would say what you said back then now, but you were you are saying now close to what you seem to be saying back then.
Yeah, no, I don't think I've changed fundamentally at all.
Yeah.
But I have changed a little bit in how I'm going about the attempt to communicate.
Do you remember you would post, I don't think you'd get much response from anybody.
No, of course not.
Yeah, nobody knew what you were talking about. Basically, you were doing what on the surface seemed to be a philosophical approach to McLuhan, which was conceptual, which was totally wrong. You know, you don't do that, Cameron, come on. But you had a different definition of everything than anybody else did. So we were both trying to dialogue and not getting anywhere. And other people were playing games. They actually weren't McLuhanites. They just came in, pretended they were interested, and then they would go on their own stuff and criticize people. So there never was any real dialogue. So when George stopped and Peter Montgomery took over, he didn't like any of us. So he kept
There's
it going.
Some...
What?
I lost you there for a few minutes. I don't know, or a few seconds, I should say.
Okay, I'll just repeat. George Sanderson did it for a few years, then he gave it up to Peter Montgomery, who was out in British Columbia, and none of us really knew Peter. And Peter didn't like us, it seemed.
Right.
He preferred Eric or George or something, the old guard. And so he put up with us for a few years, but eventually he quit. He didn't like us, so and Michael Edmonds took over. Once Michael was there, who was a friend of mine, and then a few other people, and I don't know if you were there then. You were there in the Montgomery period.
Yeah, I stopped. I couldn't take the lack of dialogue. It was just ridiculous.
Yeah. And I didn't know what you were talking about, or I didn't see how you, well, basically I thought you were wrong. And I can go back and find those things. I'll show you what I wrote to you.
They're still online.
Are they still online or on mine?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're still online.
Yeah, if you know where to go, it's in the University of Toronto system. Mike Edmonds knows that stuff. But the thing is, I don't know if you remember responding, but I would say that's all conceptual, Cameron. Where's the percept? But the so no dialogue with
me
you.
At all.
What?
Didn't bother me at all.
Yeah, and it didn't bother me. I never would have thought we'd end up like this. No way was that going to happen. But the so among the people with Michael and a few people, it was okay. And Andrew Crystal came in, and he had been at the archives in 2004, and he came on and said, "You guys are criticizing Bob, but he's the only guy close to what's going on. I've been here for 6 months reading the archives, and it's what Bob says. He's McLuhan said, you know." So he totally supported me. So that was a bit made it easier for people to talk. You know, they didn't know who Andrew was. He came out of nowhere, and he was doing the actual research at the archives. So he had a bit of authority, so they had to back off on their nonsense about me. So that only lasted a few years, till about 2008, and then Ian showed up, and I got busy with Ian. And then I listened to you in 2015, and I was surprised. This is very interesting. So I had a different approach to you in 2015, and we talked for a while, and then we waited 5 or so years, and then we're back doing this. Now we're the model of the Internet, people say. You know, in this time of everybody divided America, divided everywhere, nobody could talk to anybody. We're there calmly talking and making progress and making insights. So it's actually turned out pretty good. So yes, I would dialogue with anybody, if that's what you mean. But McLuhan would do that. He would talk to anybody.
Sure.
Anybody could drop in. And he would talk to controversial people like Tim Leary and that, or Abby Hoffman, you know, the regular academics wouldn't go near those guys, but he would do it. So
yeah.
I thought that's what people should do if you're going to shit on anybody, as McLuhan used to say. you know, we shouldn't shit on anybody. We're making shouldn't shit on anybody. I thought the whole thing was, well, listen to people, regardless of what crazy angle they come at. And I thought McLuhan represented that. And the environment was doing that. The environment was talking to everybody. That was the ground.
Yeah, that's language, right?
Yes.
Language does that. But notice how this is actually at the very heart of McLuhan's Catholicism.
Yeah.
Because for McLuhan, there were thousands of things wrong with modern Catholicism. But that didn't mean that you couldn't talk with it. Didn't mean that you couldn't look at its traditions. Right? So when people try to understand how he could be a Catholic, he could be a Catholic in the same sense that he could be on a talk show. Or
he could be a Catholic because he knew what be a Catholic was. Nobody else knew what to be a Catholic was.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, there's a new book out by a Catholic. Have you heard of it? Digital Communion.
No.
You haven't heard? Okay. But, so this is a teacher, some guy in New Jersey, who's a Catholic, a devout Catholic. And he's decided that McLuhan, if you understood his deep Catholicism, you see that he had a spiritual vision of the virtual age or the digital age. So this guy tries to bring together quotes by McLuhan. Yeah, it's pretty good. He goes through all the basic stages or angles of McLuhan's religiosity and other things. It's pretty accurate. And then he comes up with this strange vision at the end about how to don't use Teilhard de Chardin, he's not good, or Pierre Levy, or anybody else that some people are recommending. He says, McLuhan's the man. He was the perfect translator for what was going on as a Catholic. He had a sense of humor. He was learned. He was funny. And he lays out all the values you need to have in the middle of the noise. And and he's correct on that. So he's telling people, look, go to McLuhan if you want a prophet or someone who sees what we got here and the problems and the solutions in it. So it's an interesting point. The divine, he takes McLuhan, what he thinks is McLuhan's spirituality, and applies it. Says this is the closest to how we should talk about the internet and where we've gotten to in the virtual age. So I don't know if that interests you, but that's a new book.
Yeah, of course it interests me. I think it's highly important.
Yeah, so I bought the book and read it, and I'll recommend it to people.
What is the book called? Do you have it there?
Yeah, I put it out back. It's the Digital Communion. Here, just a minute. I have it down on the bar here because I'm going to post it. Here it is. Digital Communion, subtitled Marshall McLuhan's Spiritual Vision for a Virtual Age. And it just came out in March. Digital Communion, Marshall McLuhan's Spiritual Vision for a Virtual Age. He may be a professor.
Uh-huh. What's his name?
Nick Ripatrazoni. That's Ripatrazoni. Ripatrazoni. So Ripatrazoni. So now, you know, people shy away of saying things like spiritual around McLuhan, right? There's all kinds of worry about or trying to interpret McLuhan's Catholicism. Well, he didn't talk about it. That's his private stuff. He didn't bring that into his work, blah, 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 you know, all the different arguments. So it's a unique title, Marshall McLuhan's Spiritual Vision for a Virtual Age, which is, read it and see how he tries to figure out how he tries to explain this title.
Yeah. So do you read books like that online? Like, do you get a
no? I buy the book
version.
No,
you buy the book, the print version.
Yeah, I don't like reading online. I like holding books. I mark up the book. I can shift pages fast and go back and forth and get to know the book. I'm not as good at that on the digital. I can't mark it. I don't like the marking system and the editing or whatever you call it on the digital thing. So I like my pen. So, I buy everybody's book. I got pretty well every McLuhan book there is, you know, by other people.
Uh-huh.
I bought another one. Another one I just finished was an art professor. I think I told you it's called Finding Nothing. It's about the art scene, avant-garde art scene in Vancouver in the 60s and 70s. Did I tell you about that?
No. Uh-uh.
Well, this guy, Greg Betts, he's a professor at Brock University, young guy, more of an aesthete. He's into the art history, art world. And there's this book called Counterblasting Canada, which
yeah,
is...
Yeah, I know that. I have that.
Yeah, so he read his essay in there. It's very good. He has some good McLuhan quotes about McLuhan as an artist. What is art for McLuhan? So mm-hmm. I noted that. Then I saw he had a book out. It just came out recently. It's called Finding Nothing, and then a long subtitle, and it's about the concrete poets of Vancouver, Bill Bissett. Do you know that name?
No.
Or B.P. Nichol. You might have heard of him.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, B.P. Nichol. So, and Earl Burney, he's one of the older poets. And all, they had a very tumultuous art scene. The thesis is that Vancouver, by six, McLuhan came and, you know, he did the Meet and Miss the Message at the radio broadcasters in 58. And then they had this festival in the early 60s, and they brought McLuhan in for that. So McLuhan, he planted his seeds early in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And so it inspired a lot of the artists, younger artists there. So they apply McLuhan to the arts in poetry and literature. But because they were just starting out and they had a new university, Simon Fraser University, and the other one had not really developed much, it was a backwater before the 50s, so before the 60s. So all the university departments were quite open to the street poets and the people down in the ghettos, the artist ghettos, and all over the place. And so they adopted, brought these guys into academia, let them teach or talk or perform, and way more open than the Toronto scene. Toronto has the old factions, right? The snobbishness is, you know, a lot of people in the academia didn't like McLuhan. They didn't like anybody hung around him. So... So it was a lot more freer with the academics, and the academics could bring in other famous people. So they had a famous press poetry conference in 1963. Ginsberg and everybody went there. Robert Duncan, Robert Creeley, all these American poets, and then the Vancouver guys. They had their little contingent. So Greg says, okay, here is this much creativity going on. And it also reflected the counterculture and what the baby boomers were doing with their drugs and their communes and rock music and all that. So he makes a case that there was a really amazing art scene in Vancouver from 59 to 75. So he says, I'm doing a micro history of that period. And it's about finding nothing. That's the title. So that book was very interesting in how they use McLuhan. That's what I do. I find out how they use McLuhan. What angle do they take on him? And it is, you know, in the Toronto in the 60s, you know, I knew more about Toronto than Vancouver, and everybody else did. It was there was a block against Vancouver. They were too far away or something, and they didn't seem to make any impact. Now, B.P. Nichol and Bissett, they came to Toronto by the middle or late 60s. They didn't stay in Vancouver too long, even though they kept doing things out there, going back and forth. But Toronto was the scene for Canada, in my perception of what was going on, not Vancouver. So it was very interesting to find out what was going on. And in many ways, it was a livelier scene than Toronto, because Toronto had too much people trying to become professionals as soon as possible, published authors and all that. The people in Vancouver, either they had an inferiority complex, didn't think they could get published, or they didn't care, and they made their own presses. They made an incredible number of magazines and book presses. So they published each other's, their friends in that. And so it was a little more open than Toronto. Mm-hmm.
Did he mention that McLuhan was in Vancouver at UBC in 1958?
Yeah,
as you mentioned.
Oh, now here's the problem. He says that McLuhan came and spoke at some place in 59, and then
that's what I was just going to mention.
And then
come and
no, wait a minute. There's more. Then it's sort of confused that maybe he spoke in 61, but John Cage and other people around McLuhan came in this new festival conference. And so 61, 62, 63, 64. Now, I know that Gerd met McLuhan in Vancouver in early 64 at the festival of that year, 64. But they describe in, like, Terrence Gordon and maybe Marchand, the festival in 65, where it was called The Medium is the Message, and it's all about McLuhan, and they had happenings and things, but McLuhan wasn't there. But it's presented, I think, in Gordon and Marchand that he was there, and it's confused. But in this book, which has a lot of Greg Betts' only his personal collection, of, he collected all these scenes, poetry, pamphlets, stuff. So he has a pamphlet for 1965, the one that's called The Medium is the Message, the one devoted to McLuhan, and the one that McLuhan didn't show up at, because it says that McLuhan came the year before, and there was also Gerd Stern. So that confirmed to me that Gerd and McLuhan were there in 64, and that's not the, nobody talks about that. They talk about the festival in 65 inspired by McLuhan, or, and that maybe he was there, or back in 59. They don't know about the radio broadcasters. This guy doesn't. I don't think he has that in there. He doesn't have the 58 visit. The point is, but the point is, they know McLuhan was out there, and they might even have a copy of his speech or something, but they didn't, I don't know if they had any excerpts, but they didn't have any visuals of it. So that's, they know what, they have McLuhan saying something. They may just not have the right year. And they know that everybody was, you know, inspired by it. A lot of people, you know, started trying to figure out what McLuhan was saying. So now Gerd, he had a, Gerd Stern, he was interviewed by a university in the San Francisco area about his whole life. And it's online. I could send you. It's very interesting.
I have that.
Right. And he's trying to remember. He was he put his show on in November 63, like just before the Kennedy assassination, at the San Francisco Museum, the first one of major multimedia installations. And he got a letter, like a few weeks later, from somebody in Vancouver said he was at the festival. No, at the San Francisco Museum. But he never talked to Gerd. He just saw a show. But then he said, I noticed you were influenced by McLuhan. There was some evidence of that, a pamphlet or something. So he said, McLuhan's going to be here in February. Would you like to come up here and present your stuff and, you know, meet McLuhan? So Gerd and his colleagues did that. They went up there. That he couldn't remember the name of the guy. Didn't know if he was, I don't know what he said, director of a gallery or something. So it's always been a mystery who the person was. And it wasn't the guy. I don't think he invited McLuhan to the radio broadcasters, so that was something different. But going through this book, which I, you know, just got recently, there's a list of all these people who potentially could have been the person who invited McLuhan in 64. So I figure out it's probably a guy named Elvin Balkind, some strange name. So I wrote to Gerd or sent him an email. I said, is this the guy that you couldn't remember 30 years ago when you did that interview? He goes, yes, bingo, that's the guy. So it kind of reminded him of the name. You know, he had long forgotten it, but if you said it, he'd recognize it. So Gerd confirmed it, and then you see his name is listed as being involved in 64 and 65 with the festival. So that big mystery I've had for decades got solved because of this finding nothing. Posting, having in the book, the pamphlet for the 1965 Medium is the Message Festival. So, what? Yeah. Now, do you know it's confused?
Well, yeah, I think it is confused because usually people don't have the underlying documents.
Yeah.
So they pick up something in a letter or something, and then they have to try to string it together.
Yeah.
And confusion comes from the lack of evidence. But so one thing I just wanted to point out from what you were saying, people seem to know that McLuhan did come to UBC in 1959.
Not the radio broadcasters.
No.
Yes,
that
right.
Was in, that,
Yeah.
The radio broadcasters, that was May of 1958.
Right.
And he was only there briefly, and he was there by himself. And then he was asked back for the whole summer session in 1959, and he took his whole family out there.
Well, I thought he went out to California with his family.
He did.
In 59?
I don't know if they went to California in 59 or not. I'd have to
But he went to Vancouver in 59.
Yeah,
you know that.
He went to Vancouver, and he stayed there. He stayed there for, I believe, 6 weeks.
Okay.
With his family.
I don't see that in the biographies, because somebody in the Nick Betts world said this. They knew that he'd come to Vancouver in 59. They give that date, and I know they're not talking with the radio broadcasters, and I'm wondering, what are they talking about? But
yeah.
You know about this. How did you find out about that particular visit? Is it in the letters?
I'm trying to think. There is information in the UBC archive, and so I have that. But it may even be that there's information about the 1959 summer UBC session online.
Okay.
I've dealt with this a little bit in a couple posts, but it's a little vague with me at the moment, because there's hundreds of posts that have come in between my writing that and now.
Yeah.
I can look that up and send you some of the background.
Yeah, and look at Marchand's book and see what he says about that period, and Gordon's biography, if you have them. Look in those and see what they say. But other people, they'll say McLuhan came to the festival in 65, and he didn't. And other people will say he didn't go. I just read somewhere. I don't know if it was in this Divine Digital Communion book, but someone just recently was saying, oh, they say he was there, or they devote the thing there, but he didn't show up. So
Yeah. Different
views around the 65 phenomenon. But this one pamphlet about 1964 names Gerd and McLuhan. So we know it happened in 64 when Gerd, in his own letter writing, has the evidence of that. But nobody talks about that. The famous quote that came out of that is that McLuhan came up to Gerd after he gave his performance and McLuhan had done his speech, and he comes up to Gerd and says, it's interesting what you guys do, but what's this got to do with me? Which shocked Gerd, because he had just read this report he had just read the Project 69 thing, and he had gotten that through a friend of John Cage at Black Mountain College, female professor, poet, M.C. Richards, I think her name is. So, and she lived with Cage in a commune north of New York City in that early 60s period. So, Gerd was inspired by, you know, Project, early version of Understanding Media, so to speak, but he didn't understand why McLuhan didn't see the relevance of what he was doing. Because he was totally responsible, totally inspired by McLuhan, he thought. So,
yeah, remember, this is an interpretation of what McLuhan was saying. Right?
Yeah.
It was not only an interpretation of what McLuhan was saying, but an interpretation of where McLuhan was coming from and his gestures and stuff. So I don't know that reports like that can be taken as factual. I think they need to be taken as important information, but they need to be interrogated.
Well, so Gerd, he always, you know, talked about McLuhan if it ever came up. But they made the cover of Time of Life magazine twice. They became artists in their own right in the New York scene.
Sure.
So, but they inspired John Brockman, who went on to publish everybody in the Edge series. He's the major literary agent that came out of that scene. But he was a friend of Stuart Brand. Well, Gerd introduced John to Stuart, and they're all mixed in. And when I called up Brockman when I got to New York in 93, I said I'd like to get together and talk about McLuhan and all that, because he had done a book inspired by McLuhan in 69. And he said, no, I'm very busy. You want to talk to Gerd Stern. And so I'd heard of Gerd Stern. And I said, oh, okay. So he gave me the number. So I got in touch with Gerd, and that turned out to be the right guy. I didn't do it for a couple of years. Then I did. So there's a whole story how we got together. And then we invited him to Mark Stallman's, and we had a he was part of our nonlinear circle the last year or so. But Gerd and I became friends. And then he started being invited all over the world at art colleges as one of the 60s people, the only one left and alive. And he his main thing to talk to everybody was about McLuhan. So a lot of people didn't know about McLuhan. So he had, you know, interesting experience at McLuhan. So then I, about 2005, Don Thiel came to City Island where I was living. And so I arranged for Gerd to meet Don Thiel because they were born within 24 hours of each other, October 12th and 13th, 1928. And they both end up growing up in New York because Gerd was born in Germany, but the Nazis drove him out in the 30s, so they came to New York. And his mother's best friend was Henry Kissinger's mother in the some part of New York City, maybe Morningside Heights or something. And so he went to the same school as Kissinger did. So Gerd always, I call him the Forrest Gump of the art world. He bumps into everybody, and he connects with everybody. So I got him to meet Don Thiel. So he read Don Thiel's The Virtual McLuhan. Mm-hmm. And he's halfway through it, and he goes, Jesus, Bob, I never knew McLuhan was a poet, because Gerd was a poet, a traditional poet, and concrete poet, all kinds of stuff. He was a poet, and he knew Ginsberg and everybody and all that. So he goes, I never knew McLuhan was a poet, which is ridiculous. But
no, it's not, Bob, it's not.
No, okay, it's ridiculous, that one, but I know why he doesn't know it. But the point is, he was shocked, and he found Don's thesis very interesting, because as a, he's like me, a poet. So the point is that Gerd is the only expert out there that art colleges use, and he talks about McLuhan, and if it wasn't for Don Thiel, he would be way off in what he talked about on McLuhan. Not that it would matter, but to me it's ironic that he was the guy that would speak about McLuhan to these, you know, millennials, and he didn't even know McLuhan was a poet until the later years. Now, what you would say something different about that?
Well, no, I don't know different. It's a footnote to what you're saying. When you're talking about McLuhan being a poet, or lots of people talk about him being an artist, they're generally using sort of metaphorical language to describe a guy that's not using language in the way that you would expect, and who
as a professor,
and as anybody, you know, I don't think there's too many people who have minds that work like McLuhan's mind.
Yeah,
and so they say, well, he was an artist because his ideas were not formulated as a narrative. They were formulated as a mosaic, as a gestalt.
Yeah.
And people associate that with art. But I don't think that anybody thinks McLuhan was an artist, like a guy sitting in front of a easel and sort of painting or something.
Right.
And I don't think they think of him as a poet, as somebody who was composing poems.
Right.
However, about a month ago, I was going through the additions to McLuhan's books at the University of Toronto. And
what do you mean you were going through them? What does that mean?
Well, going through the spreadsheet that describes them.
Oh, okay. Of his library.
There's two spreadsheets, right? One is the books. And then the other is all the stuff that was taken out of the books. And I'm very interested in the stuff that was taken out because I don't think people have paid much attention to it.
Right.
And recently what I found was that there were some poems, and, you know, real poems that are attributed to Marshall.
Okay, good.
And so I'm beginning to think that in his own way and in a very limited fashion, McLuhan was a poet, but in a different sense from what people usually mean.
Right. Well, I consider McLuhan the most important poet and artist of the baby boomers' experience of the 60s and 70s. And it was a new kind of poetry, a new kind of art. And he was pointing to a new kind of landscape. Well, you could say the digital media. When we talked about last time, media is art forms. The media are the art forms. So he worked in that kind of understanding. So he made art in a way that no one else did, and his lasts as long as Finnegan's Wake. And that was good. He was responding to Finnegan's Wake. He was responding to what he thought was the greatest art before him. So he kept the tradition going, and he was part of that, you know, lofty dialogue, or insightful or low-brow dialogue, whatever you want to say. So not anybody, Mick Jagger to Andy Warhol or Zappa, although I think Zappa was pretty good on the music part, but nobody was as comprehensive as McLuhan. So McLuhan is the Francis Bacon or the Picasso or Shakespeare of our time. That's what I think now. What do you think of that one?
I don't know if that's sort of the line that I would put him in, but I don't violently disagree with anything you said there. The only thing I would want to look into is when you use the word art form or the term art form, I think we'd need to think a lot about
what that meant.
What is an art form? It's not like a painting or poetry or dance or theater. I mean, all of these things are could be called art forms where the F in form is a small F. But what happens if we capitalize the F? And I think when you talk about the media being the art form of our time, I think you're talking about art form with a capital F. And what does that mean? It means that we can't go from art forms to a concept of art form. Instead, we need to understand that art forms are basic. They're already there. And the various art forms with a small F are derivatives from it. They're not something that will lead us to it. And that, does that make sense to you?
Yeah. So because the world where everything became art, because everything was the content of the satellite, you could say, so everything, every object, every landscape, or every scape was an art now,
as
content.
True.
And Marshall found out a way to write about that and create a vision or a perspective or a detachment from it to make an artwork about it.
So I agree with that.
Yeah. So then you look at what he writes about Warhol. Warhol did pop art, and he goes on about Warhol took his present. He made an art form out of his present, which was called the factory back then when he had this place that people come and do anything, and he'd videotape them or film them. McLuhan knew how to put that in a framework and show, oh, that's a knee-jerk effect. Warhol is an effect. It doesn't offer perception. And McLuhan came up with a way to offer perception, just the way advertising was an art form but didn't offer perception. So he spoke about Warhol and everything else that happened with the most amazing framework or capital F form than anybody else did. Most other people still don't know what to say about Warhol. You know, they waffle on whether he was an artist or not. But McLuhan knew precise that if you take the present as an art form, you're dealing with the electric now, which has no content, and there is no present. So therefore, the present becomes art form. That's the last thing we recognize that we could know. And so
you're using the word perception there.
Yeah.
To be the correlate of art form.
Yeah.
And I think that's correct.
Yeah, see, he could write about and fit it into a system in quotes, about anything that was going on. No one else could do that. They'd fall back on value judgments about what was going on. He talked technically.
Right.
He wrote technically. And it all fit his categorization, which was the role of the book. The book says, oh, there it is. Do you got to deal with that?
I'm sorry. That's the dog, right?
Yeah, go ahead. Do what you have to do.
Yeah. Okay. Take it. Just be quiet. Be quiet. He has an interesting way of getting what he wants. He just terrorizes you.
Now he's whining.
Yeah. Because he knows that he's going to get his food, and he's having trouble in. Hey, geez, relax. He's a good dog, that one. That's Kennedy, who's blind in one eye, but he just tears around. You would think a dog with no depth perception would keep banging into things if they're running fast, but not him.
He's got it down.
That's right.
He's the.
So I'll be done with this in a couple seconds.
Okay.
Excuse me for.
He's the Jacques Lussieran of the dog kingdom.
That's right. That is absolutely right. Tactility squared.
Is it Jacques Lussieran? Something Lussieran. J somebody.
Yeah, Jacques.
Yeah, Jacques Lussieran.
Yeah. Okay. I'm in the final stage. Sorry.
Is he celebrating that you're giving him food?
Sorry?
He's celebrating that you're giving him food.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He loves that. And then he spent his entire life with another... Hey, stop it. He spent his entire life with another dog, Miles, who was a couple of years older. And when Miles ate, he always barked like this. And Kennedy never did. But then Miles died, and Kennedy started to bark just like Miles did. Yeah, so I'm just mixing up their stuff. And
the owners, they're into 1963, Miles Davis and John Kennedy.
Yeah.
They named their dogs after those guys.
That's right. Okay, boys, here we go.
There you go.
All right, they'll be quiet now.
Okay, so we were saying, talking about art, perception. You see, people used to say you can bring up any topic with McLuhan, he's got something to say about it. Well, it was more than that. He had a system, He could put on a system, a pagan secular system. And what was interesting was to find out the system and see how he applied it like a formula all over the place once you crack his code. That was what was interesting.
So think how absurd it would be if you had somebody that was doing physics, let's say, and then you come to him and you say, well, what do you think is going on here physically? And then if he said, well, physics doesn't apply to that, you would think it was ridiculous. The same with chemistry. Or if you come up to a biologist and you say, look, here's this microbe, what do you think's going on? He says, biology doesn't deal with that. I mean, it would make no sense whatsoever. So what you're talking about is sort of a mark of talking sense.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as, oh, that doesn't fit into my system or something. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. And McLuhan countered that, and he got in trouble for it. he violated that bias by saying
he said that himself, right? That his bias was in, he was interested in all biases.
Yeah. He said that was the bias of our age, was looking at the bias of everything else.
Correct. Which makes tremendous sense, and it not only makes sense, it's the only conceivable way of us having peace.
Yeah.
Right? P-E-A-C-E. And unless you're able to approach literally everything and everybody in some mode of dialogue, then there will never be peace, because the only way to come, if you can't dialogue, the only way to come to terms with a situation like that is violently, to say, I know the truth of this, or I know the reality of this, or I've decided that this person can't be talked to, and you don't have peace.
That's right. The that's what in the Finding Nothing book, Betts admires the professors being open to the non-academic artists in the streets of Vancouver. They were trying to apply, they were inspired maybe by McLuhan, that, oh, geez, everything is art now, so let's talk to anybody that that puts on a pose of creating something. So, so you wouldn't see that in Toronto. Oh, no, everything was fragmented and hierarchized, and you just end up listening to Neil Young in Yorkville. That's all you had, since the academics wouldn't talk to you.
Yeah, well, you had different, and the thing about Toronto is it's so big, and there's the different universities and the different schools of thought, and it's a mishmash rather than an environment where you can have dialogue of the high and the low and the in and the out.
And McLuhan attempted to give a program of dialogue for people there, and they didn't like it.
Go ahead.
So, well, the establishment didn't like it. You know that he was censored in Parliament by the Governor General.
Well, no, the Governor General isn't in Parliament, but
he made a Vanier. He made a special address or something, message, and he said, Parliament's got to do something about this guy. He's out of control.
Yeah, maybe.
Have I brought that up before? I think I have.
Yeah. You know, didn't Vanier head the Royal Commission in 1950 or 1951?
Yeah, maybe.
Canadian culture, and then McLuhan was vociferous about its failings.
Yes, he said, it just illustrated the Canadian cultural tradition that when a problem comes up, you have a commission about it.
Yeah,
that was a Canadian cultural response. It was like an art form in itself in Canada's culture.
Correct.
I guess they didn't like that. So, okay, so let's go into page 103.
Yeah, sorry, Bob. We got off. Oh, I should say, remember, in the period you're talking about in Vancouver, that's when Maury Schaefer was there. So,
Morley Schaefer? Schaefer? You mean the 60 Minutes?
No. The music guy. Maybe I'm...
No, Murray Schaefer.
Murray. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
And his theory from McLuhan was that... the cityscape is already music, so closely related to Cage's ideas, right?
Yeah.
But it fits with this idea of universal dialogue.
That's right, and you know, Murray Schaefer's valuable statement about being a student of McLuhan in 51 or so, way back there, he said McLuhan taught that Fitting His Wake was not a book, it was a radio program. And then Murray goes on to do a lot of his art on the radio, on CBC.
Uh-huh.
probably inspired by McLuhan's notion that Sidney's Wake was not a book. It was a radio program. So that broadens the, or gets rid of the hierarchies, and you start looking at the city as music.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then, and the noise is music.
Yeah.
And the idea that that there's dialogue going on with, between all sounds. So that's a very Finnegan's Wake idea.
Yeah.
That every sound and every word and every punctuation mark is already dialogue in some sense.
Yep. So, yeah, did Murray Schafer, did he grow up in Vancouver?
No, no. He's an Ontario kid.
But he, you associate him with the Vancouver scene.
No, he was at Simon Fraser University for, I don't know, I think 10 or 20 years.
Oh, he taught there.
That's where he did most of his theoretical work.
Okay, let me
and
look
he had
that
a,
up.
He had a program there of teams of people that would make recordings of the cityscape.
Right.
And they would do that all over the world, but the main place they did it was Vancouver.
Well, looking at the wiki on him, he born in Sarnia, Ontario. Yeah, his right. music education theories are followed around the world. He started soundscape studies at Simon Fraser University in the 1960s.
Correct.
Yeah, so that's
there
where
you go.
Yeah.
And how long did he stay there? At least 10 years, I think.
Yeah, he doesn't say. It's a skimpy outline of his biography.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Unless there's a list at the bottom here, compositions, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, no, I won't say.
Choir, voice, let's see, written works. No, it doesn't go too much into his academia, so I guess he did it all at Simon Fraser, basically.
Well, that's where he taught at Simon Fraser, I believe, for 15 or more years.
Right.
And then he decided that he wanted to establish a kind of, what could I say, an oasis of music that would be include the unplanned sounds of nature. And that's what he did at his farm in Ontario.
Yeah, that's what. Here's what it is. Would you say he did it at a farm in Ontario?
Yeah, yeah. That's where he went after Simon Fraser. He went. He bought a farm in Ontario and just went there.
Okay, so it says here the World Soundscape Project was established.
Yeah, that's SFU.
Yeah, was an educational research group by Murray at Simon Fraser during the late '60s and early
'70s. Yeah.
This. It grew out of Schafer's initial attempt to draw attention to the sonic environment through a course in noise pollution, as well as from his personal distaste for the more raucous aspects of Vancouver's rapidly changing soundscape. This work resulted in two small educational booklets.
Yeah, so did the guy that you mentioned before, Betts, I think you said,
yeah, Gregory
Betts. Does he mention Schafer being part of that scene?
I don't think so.
Yeah, because, I mean, but look at that. That's crazy, right?
Yeah.
He was very important to that scene because he was introducing this idea that there is already dialogue in the environment going on between sounds, right?
Right.
And between all human actions and their surrounding sounds. So that's a very McLuhan-esque idea, and it's... you can see that informing the idea that Betts was talking about of street people dialoguing with the universities and with, you know, an exchange of information going on. That's dialogue.
Yeah, it sounds like they say here his personal distaste for the more raucous aspects of Vancouver's rapidly changing soundscape sounds like Murray didn't like what this book, Betts' book, is about. probably thought there was a lot too much noise culturally from these people.
Maybe. I don't know that is talking about cultural noise. He might have thought that he might have been talking about the idea that just as humans don't pay any attention to light pollution, they don't pay any attention to noise pollution.
Mm.
So for hundreds of thousands of years, humans were geared into their acoustic environment in a way where there was constant feedback. And modern humans, in their stupidity, have decided that the only feedback they want is from themselves, right? And so everybody's going around listening to what some other human put on the internet or something.
So they have a picture here of a bunch of his colleagues at Simon Fraser. I don't recognize one name from the, but that's his book. So I think maybe he was concentrating on poetry and art, not music.
Yeah, unfortunately, right?
Yeah. Well, I'll double check the book.
Maybe that's what he'll do next. Maybe he'll look into that.
Yeah, I'll look into the book just to make sure. But there's certainly nothing much about Schaefer that I recall in reading the book. And I read it closely. So, okay, so we got sidetracked into Murray Schaefer.
Yeah, sorry, Bob.
That's all right. So we're now doing 103, and I said we left off talking about Jung and the archetype.
Yeah, and by the way, and as I have mentioned to you offline, I'm reading a lot of McLuhan's unpublished stuff from the 40s, and there's a lot of discussion of Jung in those writings.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so as I look down 104, 105, 106, we did a lot of this stuff. We did the
That's because War and Peace in the Global Village, that concluding passage, you also quoted earlier in the book. I think it's around page 80, 82 maybe.
Yeah.
And so we've talked about this quotation. But the fact that you've reused it must mean that you understand that passage in different contexts of McLuhan's thought.
Okay, so we did all this stuff about the connubial bliss and the interaction of media as animals. I don't want to do that. So I'm looking for where. So what I come up with is 103, I'm saying in the blue part, my casual talk, I say, McLuhan's highlighting another angle, the archetypal power. Not many people knew that McLuhan had one-upped Jung. I have that excellent quotation by William Irwin Thompson where he runs through the different conceptual unconsciousnesses. This is Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung, Claude Levi-Strauss, Gregory Bateson, but he leaves out McLuhan. He should know better. Frank Zingroni, a longtime friend and colleague of Thompson, is smart enough to notice, quote, Frank says, just a minute, I hit the thing, says, McLuhan is going past Jung, and he's trying to talk about it. And Zingroni marvels, who would have thought anyone could alter the idea of an archetype after the dominance of that area by Jung? And then I say, McLuhan did that. So that's where we left off. Is there anything you want to say about McLuhan's idea of archetype that's post-Jung?
Well, I don't like the idea of post Jung. I don't like the idea of going past Jung. These things are chronological. So McLuhan took up the notion of archetype and showed that it was in constant dialogue with cliché. Carl Jung helped him to get there. I would just say that anybody who's interested in McLuhan needs to understand something of Jung, needs to understand that Jung was topical at the University of Toronto at that time. Northrop Frye was very interested in Jung for decades. So Jung is somebody that needs to be taken seriously by anybody that wants to understand McLuhan, no question about that.
So the archetypes that that Jung talked about, people think are in the brain or in the collective unconscious, wherever that is. They're in humans, and they're anthropomorphic images.
That's ridiculous. That's a ridiculous way to read Jung. It's the exact opposite. The archetypes are dominants. That is to say that they're divine-like figures that have already pre-shaped everything that humans do.
Right, but he doesn't have radio and TV as archetypes in there, does he?
No, of course not.
All right.
Yeah.
And that's what I say. McLuhan said, okay, the archetype isn't some inky mystical thing in our collective unconscious or in our brains or something. It is the environments we use, and we become numb to them. So they have an effect on us that we don't notice. And
but that's why McLuhan liked the idea of the collective unconscious, which he took to be something like language.
Right, but then he said we're in a collective conscious situation. And how we got to that was the interesting, quote, post-Jung situation. He said that the unconscious is what people commercialized, marketed to people. The somnambulist, when we were actually in a collective consciousness, you know, that Leonard Cohen was trying to get at in his 93 song about Everybody Knows. You know that song where he says Everybody Knows? And I think there's an earlier song where he says something similar. So McLuhan was explaining what this environmental situation of collective consciousness was. And that meant getting out of the assumption that people were motivated by subconscious forces. The media were the subconscious forces. They were in your environment. They could be noticed and looked at, not some vague ideas in your dreams or something, or in the cultural archetypes that were in poems and art and that Jung talked about. And that
my problem with that is that what Jung was trying to do was communicate something. McLuhan was trying to communicate something. And I don't know that either one of them were all that successful in doing it. I mean, it's a very difficult thing to actually communicate the possibility of the universe making sense. And so it's not as if McLuhan, was able to make these things crystal clear and pass it on to everybody. The McLuhan industry is dedicated to forgetting about McLuhan as fast as it can. And outside of the McLuhan industry, nobody's paying any attention to him at all.
Right. So I claim to apply this new post-Jungian aspect of McLuhan this way. When people, if you start questioning what's the unconscious in that, they'll have theories about it, and ultimately they don't know what it is, but they think they're supposed to be controlled by it. I said, well, how about looking at your unconscious as the couch in your living room, the tables, and then the radio and TV? Now, those are real things, and they are having effects on you that you're not aware of. They're having effects on everybody. So why not call that the unconscious rather than strange psychological processes?
Yeah, but I don't think you want to say that because your table is having unconscious effects on you, the material table is the ultimate reality of the universe.
No, I'm not saying the ultimate reality. I'm saying this is a practical application of the idea of the unconscious. Because there's a lot of mysticism or babble, psychobabble, that comes out of Jung and Freud and all those other psychologies that came after Jung, the human potential movement stuff. What about the environments themselves that everybody can see, but they don't think about or don't know how to think about it? Let's look at that as our unconscious. And so that usually sparks people's interest. That's how I get them interested in McLuhan.
No, I think that's true. But when you say, let's look at that, right? Apparently you mean the physical universe around us.
Yeah.
But just the sciences for thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of years, when people looked at that, meaning the physical universe, they knew very well what they were talking about, trees and rocks and water and clouds and all that sort of stuff, but they didn't know what it was. So you're talking about people looking at their built environment and saying, well, people have to understand that, and especially they have to understand it in terms of art forms. Well, that's right, but does anybody really know what an art form is? Any more than they know what an archetype is? I don't think so.
Well, McLuhan used to call it a teaching machine, and I like that term. Art is a teaching machine. So your coach, your setup in your living room is a teaching machine.
Sure.
And you can talk about it and point it out to people.
Yeah. But where does that get you?
It makes them think they become aware of something.
Oh, well, you know.
Okay. So then they understand media ecology.
That's like advertising or something.
Yeah, and then they join Bob in demanding a media fast. They've become conscious. They become really woke. See, that's the woke I would recommend if I was ever mingled with the wokus that are out there today. I'd bring in what we should be woke about. And I'd call it people don't think of that as the unconscious, these environments. They think of the content as MK Ultra CIA mind control things that are making people brain dead or stupid or duped. No, that's far from what's going on. That's not what's duping people. People, they study the content to see what is tricking them. That's how they talk about these TV shows. They say, see what they're trying to do to us? They're trying to tell us this, trying to tell us that. They're very sophisticated about the content, but they don't know anything about the formal dynamics that McLuhan was pointing out. So
Correct. You
can take over any conversation with these ideas.
That's why McLuhan argued against paying attention to hidden persuaders, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, he wasn't interested in that.
That's
right. So you and I completely agree on this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's just that for me, the most important thing is the questionability of these things. Whereas to me, when you're talking about the sort of the new woke, I don't know that the new woke includes deep questions.
Say it again. You don't know if they're woke or in his questions?
No, that you were talking about.
Yeah, the woke.
Being unwoke, I think, is a nice word you use to go beyond woke. And so I'm asking if how far is questionability in your notion of the unwoke? Because to me, it seems more like an answer than a question.
Well, it's an answer that gets them thinking they're getting somewhere. Then they bump into the questions. So you fool them. They get into, well, this makes sense. Well, I can make something out of this, Bob. Then they go and they try to apply for a couple of weeks, and they come back and explain all the backfirings and complications that happened. It didn't work. And then we go into why it didn't work, why you thought it was an answer. And then that's how we get to the questionability.
It's a strategy.
Yes, it's Dobbsian strategy. That's right.
All right.
That's the rhetorician. That's what I do. always trying to think up new ways. So, you know, McLuhan wrote to Playboy, I think I sent it to you, in 1970, saying that Eliot's auditory imagination was normal cliche awareness. In 1970, that was due to music and the taking over of the music environment. In the 50s, 60s. And then he says, but what is not in the public awareness yet is Finnegan's Wake. That was still not noticed, just as Eliot's acoustic imagination was not noticed in, the 20s and 30s, but by the 60s, people thought that was their big revelation. They were tuning into their audio spaces, getting out of their visual space. So Eliot came into his day. Now, it's interesting that, you know, the great title, Finnegan's Wake, here it is 50 years later from that Playboy letter, and the word woke comes into the language. And it's like that is the popular perception of Finnegan's Wake now becoming cliche awareness. Now, this leads to all kinds of distortions and tiger traps and elephant cages, as McLuhan used to say. But I would say, as a headline, Dobbs announces that Finney's Wake is now ordinary awareness. What do you mean by that, Mr. Dobbs? Where do you get that? Well, look, everybody's using the word wake or woke. Nobody else ever used it that way or even claimed they were doing it. And the book that laid out the map to that was Finney's Wake. So everybody's talking Finney's Wake. They may not know it, but it's become ordinary awareness. And you think of the cultural pattern recognition, the hyper-pattern recognition that's going on every day by people in different media environments and having opinions about whatever their insights are, that's Finnegan's Wake. That's the way we live today. There's millions of insights and patterns offered in Finnegan's Wake, which was the condition people are in today that Finnegan's Wake predicted. McLuhan was on Front Page Challenge about 1970. Remember that show, Front Page
yes.
Challenge? And he was a topic that then they a news story, and then they guessed him or didn't, and then they bring him on. He talks to people. And I always remember they said something. He said, well, businessmen are interested in ideas. Now, at that point, the counterculture and everybody else was running around complaining about businessmen and capitalists. They weren't interested in ideas. They were just exploiting everybody and being capitalists and imperialists and all this stuff. And there was a populist attempt to make a democracy counter to the oligarchy. So what was I going to say about that?
Front Page Challenge.
Oh yeah. So when he said businessmen are interested in ideas, nobody. That's nuts, Marshall. They're not interested in ideas. They don't have an idea in their head. They don't care about culture. But I think McLuhan knew what he was talking about. He knew cultures are business, and actually businessmen were exploiting the new software cultures, the new content, the leisure society industries. And so they were interested in ideas. So ideas are not what we're trying to get to. If you want to be anti-business, you would not engage ideas as content. You'd engage in whatever Marshall was trying to say Finney's Wake was showing us, pattern recognitions, not necessarily ideas. So you have people today have millions of ideas. We have no shortage of ideas about everything. Everybody is quite inspired, drunk on ideas, writing about it, and making movies, blogs, and all kinds of things. And that is cliche awareness. Actually, we don't need a whole bunch of ideas. If you get what McLuhan's saying, you got one idea, one notion, one form about, or one question about what are the issues on that you can apply as a formula to all kinds of activities, like McLuhan did. So right when everybody got involved with the great democracy of idea and dialogue was when dialogue was obsolete, and there was a new kind of dialogue necessary. And McLuhan called it a complex clairaudience or clairvoyance. Remember that phrase? Complex clairvoyance. We were all engaging in a collective consciousness.
Yes. Well, just as humans, because that's what language is, and there are no humans aside from language.
Right. And language had become nonverbal. Post-verbal, parallel verbal, gestural. It became environmental, where everybody was in the resonant node and could see what was going on. The question was then which culture, which tradition would dominate the historical traditions they could claim that made them more important than the other guy's tradition. So McLuhan, you know, he cited Menippean Satirist as his tradition. You know, going back to, say, Rabelais, Tristram Stern, Pope, Swift, maybe someone else I'm forgetting in the 19th century, and then he gets into Pound and Joyce. He just has a whole sequence of writers that are Menippean satirists that he cited as his tradition, and he always talked about them. I guess Mallarmé, Flaubert, Baudelaire. So that was McLuhan's tradition. Other people would celebrate Karl Marx or Freddie Engels or some anarchists, Kropotkin or something. There was the battle of the traditions. And so a lot of public intellectuals, Thompson had his own mystical, theosophical tradition he would quote. Thompson was interesting because he did include Finnegan's Wake in his. Not many other people, Marxists don't include Finnegan's Wake. Then there's art historian traditions. So right. We have a battle.
See, in all of this stuff, people don't really know what's going on. Right? What they're doing is they're expressing a point of view. So what they're doing is they're coming from the Gutenberg galaxy and attempting to understand the cosmic reality. But you can't do that. That's exercising what McLuhan called light on.
Yeah.
But instead, the only way to make sense of the galaxy is to come from the cosmos to it, which is what he called light through.
Yep. So I call these environments or these traditions mythic stages. And the culture war is, you know, Harold Bloom comes along and says, okay, there's the Western canon, nothing's more valuable than that. And all you feminists out there trying to make a new canon with stuff that's mediocre, go back to the old canon. So that was Bloom's mythic stage, those people. Mm-hmm. And you could make a case for whatever the feminists were coming up with, since women were suppressed and ignored or had difficulty maintaining their own freedom. I mean, they had to have pen names and all this stuff, disguises. So that's another tradition. So you get the battle of knowledge, and all these things are Gutenbergian stream of consciousness, of tradition. Battle of the mythic stages. And that is what makes wealth and makes cultural debate, but it's not the debate that's really important. You got to drop all that stuff. And then that's why you would talk to pretty well anybody, because we're dealing with a phenomenon where the global classroom is educating everybody in all bizarre ways because they come at it from different histories. So it's always interesting to talk to anybody today. You could say that the average citizen is way more interesting than they were 100, 200 years ago because of what they have to process every day, and the autonomy they have in doing that, and they're processing stuff that you don't even know about. Their experience, and there's a whole range of different kinds of experiences and traditions that people can study. So you now have that on the blogs. There's many, many forms where people are talking about cultural ancestors that they value. There's hundreds of them.
Notice that, what you're saying is that there's been intellectual progress.
Yeah.
Right? People are more...
Not progress, but...
I believe exactly the opposite. There's been intellectual dumbing down.
Yes, but wait a minute. So the dumbing down is because they don't understand that what they are experiencing and making themselves unique is not the issue. So you have everybody has their expertise, and what they find interesting, and they read books and go to movies and studies, find strange things to study, and then they might find somebody they can talk about. But you have to sit back and look at the range of content, cultural content, that people have access to and discuss, but they don't know what's going on. It's like right when the simplest answers are available due to the collective clairvoyance that McLuhan's talking about, that's when everybody gets distracted by millions of data bytes of cultural content. So right when we don't need content, there's a lot of it because it's obsolete. And everybody is picking their tradition to vote for in that. And yet, if I took over the United Nations and forced everybody to listen to me, I could lay out what the Esperanto is, the collective Esperanto, and make everybody see it. That's right. I don't need to know about this, that, or the other thing. It's what Bob's talking about. We're all in that boat. Okay, so I put that on C. Kellen in the 80s. It was a strategy to point out that everybody was awake enough and that we had to change our idea of what motivated somnambulism is. So when you start complaining that people are getting dumber, that's not the right language for what's happening to people. They're not getting dumber. They're getting smarter on the content level. And Baudrillard said, Baudrillard said this. He said, the problem today is that people know too much. See, but they know all kinds of Gutenbergian bits and fragments in music, art, poetry, literature, sculpture, opera, hockey, baseball, millions of data. It's incredible the content in everybody's brains, how much it has. But that's not the ersatz any environment that we require.
Correct.
Finally, I get it correct out of Cameron. Hey, correct. Now, what am I correct about? Let's find out what you think you mean.
Well, when you talk about the content amounting to nothing,
yeah,
and people not knowing where it's at because the content gets in their way, and the notion of content getting in people's way as being Gutenbergian, all of that is true.
Yeah,
I would simply say that for me personally, if people don't come to realize that their supposed insights amount literally to nothing,
right?
That they dissolve into thin air, that they cannot get to the real stuff, what you were earlier calling the art forms,
yeah,
or perceptions.
Yeah.
They cannot understand what's really going on in their environment until they let go of the stuff that they think is important.
And they're proud that they know.
That's right. That's right. That's the most difficult thing.
Yeah.
That there's a correlation between identity and world.
Yeah.
And so if people are going to give up a false notion of the world, they have to give up a false notion of their own identity. And people find that very hard to do.
Yeah, so I look at a lot of different Facebook forums. They're all over the place. And it's remarkable how people talk among themselves about how stupid everybody else is. Most of them are quite despairing. They said, we're not going to, you know, there's just too many ignorant people out there. And they have no clue of the ignorance of what their sophistication really is. You know what I mean? They really... I watch the intelligence. They quote learned stuff all over the place, you know, whatever they're reading. And it's all, as McLuhan said, you know, baby powder gets in their eyes.
Yeah.
Cosmic dust that gets in their eyes. And it's impossible to get them to wake up from that. They have so many cultural biases. You know, they think when they go to the Ontario Art College or the museum, they're doing something. The Royal Ontario Museum, let's go get some culture. You know, or they watch some interesting TV shows. What they value is what they don't want to question.
Yeah, okay, I completely agree with that.
Yeah.
So, but how you think that sort of overwhelming reality amounts to people getting smarter? I don't agree with that.
That's the invisible
maybe,
part.
Maybe you're using smarter in quotes or something.
No, they don't. They don't know how they become smarter. They're thinking smart is the kind of stuff they talk about, their content.
Correct. Yeah, so in other words, if we want to talk about really getting smart, then that's not what's going on out there.
Right.
What's going on out there is getting dumber, and the only way out of that cul-de-sac is to go deeper into the dumb,
yep,
to explore our ignorance. And what that amounts to on a personal level is giving up the sense of identity and the sense of driving the car of identity that was structuring that world. Humans have the ability to fall out of false identities. And that's really the key to us ever getting to a mutual understanding.
Yeah, and the I think a lot of people should hear our dialogue is what I think. Because we're saying things a bit different from what they're used to. Nobody says what we say. That all that stuff you think makes you smart and you're despairing because the majority of the population doesn't know anything about what you think is valuable, not you, but anybody, and you don't want to question that, there's the problem.
Absolutely.
And they don't want to look at that. So, but then there's you can find people who think that they, yeah, I agree with you, Bob, but then, no, they've got a whole bunch of stuff they value. If they had a chance, they'd impose that on people. I wouldn't impose cultural content on people and impose something else. And that remains secret for now, what I'm going to impose on people. So let's look at my words here to see if it gets if what we're talking about is what I'm trying to point out here. So I have here 104, 103, that's about the archetype and whether Jung is important or not.
Yeah. Then but don't skip over the Android meme part here.
Where's that?
I think that's in the middle of 103.
Okay, because that's what I'm coming
to. The hidden ground is the Android meme.
Yeah, because I have here, McLuhan is here talking about the analog media phase culminating in the global theater. So the content of the global theater is the analog media, and that's Gutenberg and Marconi media. Marconi, now the first half of the 20th century and the 19th and 18th centuries would be the content of the global theater or of analog media, right? Analog media phase. So then the hidden ground of that is the Android meme. The digital is being built at MIT and other high-tech centers, and they started hooking up the computers in September 69 at UCLA. That began the Internet. This quotation below is from November 69. So here's what McLuhan said. The 70s will see the end of solutions. Pattern recognition via inspection of multiple problems will bring an end to the hidden environments. Now, he's saying that we will become aware, like McLuhan, pretty close to McLuhan, we will see the hidden environments, but we won't know why we see the hidden environments. So he's saying the end of solution means the beginning of questions, the importance of questions, which is what he announces in his debate with Miller in The Listener in that period, 70, 71.
Right.
He says, you know, you guys get all these answers. Go ahead.
But I just want to point out that this is a wonderful quotation that you have here from 1969.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about it is that it's still in our future today.
Yeah.
Right? So this is over 50 years ago. And what he's saying is coming in a couple of years, he calls it the 70s. Well, in 2022, we're nowhere near that.
It's a very good issue of the Do Line, Volume 2, Number 3. It's a poster. Have you ever seen it?
I don't know. I've got the content in my file somewhere, but I don't know that I've actually seen the poster.
Yeah, this is it. So it has a lot of great statements on it. It's a whole new McLuhan. The only person I discussed it with was Andrew Crystal. He saw it. Maybe he got one when he was in Ottawa. So we went through it all. Said, now there's the new McLuhan of the 70s that no one even was aware of, and this was a good sample statement. The end of solutions. So what replaces that? Well, it becomes questions, which are the solutions. Pattern recognition via inspection of multiple problems will bring an end to the hidden environments. See, that's a way of saying we will become collectively conscious.
Right. I completely agree with that.
All right.
And my way of talking about that is to say that we need to enter into the scientific investigation of the new field of the interior landscape. Is the interior landscape only interior? No, of course not. The interior landscape is the exterior landscape correlated with the subjects that see it. Right? So the end of solutions is the end of people existing in environments that they don't understand. And how does that come about? It comes about through pattern recognition.
Right. So let's see if what I say or the next quote gets to what you just said. So I go, that's a very big statement. The end of solutions. They all thought McLuhan still believed he had solutions, but he was telling him, no, I'll tell you what you don't know. We aren't going to have solutions. And then I say, McLuhan is saying everybody would start to see the hidden environments due to speed up. It wouldn't be the province of the artist or the McLuhanite. Everybody would be forced to see what was happening, and that's what happened over the next 30 years. So that's 70 to 2000. People started to notice. Quote, you know, this technology is doing something to us. You know, the medium is massaging me. Whether they knew about McLuhan or what he said or not, this was a sentence on a big poster he had made. I was talking about this with Andrew Crystal back in 2004, and I said, look, see, he has a whole new statement at the beginning of 1970. We called it, me and Andrew called it the later McLuhan, and he used that phrase in his PhD. Oh, I say that. I didn't know I said all this when I was telling you 2 minutes ago that it was coming up, and he used that pattern in his PhD. So then I go, however, in this phase of the global theater metaphor, McLuhan got the more relevant insights first. Neil Postman, in quotes, were amusing herself to death, 1985, did not see what McLuhan saw in 1968. So I then say, these are very important quotations. This is the matrix. Then we come to the next quote from War and Peace in 1968. The important thing is to realize that electric information systems are live environments in the full organic sense. So now we're getting into the Android meme. And we have talked about that quote before. And then I go, something came alive, and that's when everybody's looking at 2001, A Space Odyssey, a movie about computers coming alive. And then we have another statement of aliveness. McLuhan says in Playboy, our whole cultural habitat, which we once viewed as a mere container of people, is being transformed by these media and by space satellites into a living organism, itself contained within a new macrocosm or connubium of a superterrestrial nature. And then you have been writing about connubium in your most recent stuff, trying to figure out what this means or to state it. So I go, that's another very big statement. And he was expressing ideas like these in the interview as if he had talked it. People couldn't believe it when they read the Playboy magazine interview. They said, what human talks like this? He was talking like a, McLuhan was talking like a book, but actually he wasn't talking, he was writing it. But he could talk it if someone was around to understand him. But these are perfect statements. Remember I told you that Eric Norden couldn't understand him, what he was saying, so he told him to write out the answers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then we get into what we talked about before, the mammalian, the different kinds of aliveness. So McLuhan says on the bottom of the quote, it is the cultural habitat in which we have long been accustomed to think that people were contained that has now become the mammal itself, now contain a new macrocosm or connubium of a superterrestrial kind. Our technologies are or self-amputations, and the environments or habitats which they create must now become the matrix of that macrocosmic connubial bliss derided by the evolutionists. Now, we've talked much about this, and I'm whipping through them because we're trying to get to the Android meme, which is coming up after the global theater. Let's see, I say our whole cultural habitat, which we once viewed as a mere container of people, that's the same idea in what he just said. The world you think you live in, walking around in your chemical body, that's what you think is the world. You don't notice you've been discarnate and all over the world on your telephone. Now, before we go into the next part, I made a big discovery the other day. Going through Finney's Wake with Ion on the show, we were doing the center of the book, page 293, where the diagram is, the geometric figure. You know that part of Finney's Wake? Have you got Finney's Wake there?
I'm trying to remember it, but I can't at the moment. So.
Yeah, there's a design called the Vesica Pisces there on page 293. Well, we started going into analyzing 293, and we started on in the middle of 292. And right there, opposite the chart in the middle of the book, line 15 on page 292, was McLuhan using the word discarnate. Now, I knew he used the word disincarnated. That was the closest that I thought was in Finning's Wake. I never could find discarnate. Now, I have a concordance with every word in Finney's Wake. And for some reason, I missed the word discarnate all these years. I knew disincarnated, but I never saw the word discarnate looking in the concordance. So here it is, right there in the middle of the page at the center of the book. And I said, so I posted a word that McLuhan used mostly more than any other word in his public talks. You know, he might say the medium is the message or the global village, but the word he was really talking about in the late and repeated a lot was discarnate. And there it is, right in the center of Finnegan's Wake. And there's other stuff around it. So I remembered the other stuff around it, you know, like lines 10 to 25, and discarnate is in line 15. So I said, where is that? That's in War and Peace. So I scanned through War and Peace, and there it was on page 14 and 15. It's a picture of an ape, and he has this quote of that section, the middle of page 292, but he leaves out the word discarnate. That's not there. It would have really stood out if it was there. And then so I find out this late date that he actually was using a word that was coming from the center of Finnegan's Wake. You know, linearly speaking, the center. So I then went and checked my concordance. Wow, there it is, discarnate. It's only used once. I missed that all these years. And I think everybody else missed it. Nobody noticed that the word that McLuhan said most was coming from the central diagram and the words around it. And right above it is a talk about Wyndham Lewis and Time and Western Man. Joyce has a joke, Spice and West End Woman, he calls it. And there's other interesting things in there, but there's something you could write about, the use of discarnate from Finney's Wake. And it is one of his most used words. Would you agree?
Well, I was just going to ask you about that. McLuhan certainly did use the word discarnate, especially in his later works. Was it, you know, his main word in the 1970s?
Yeah.
Maybe. I would tend more towards discontinuity, but...
No, that's more... That's the 60s. You go up to the Mike McManus interview in 77, 78 in there. He's pointing out how we have no bodies, and he says we are discarnate.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, he talks about that a whole lot. I'm not denying that.
And I'm saying he talks about many other things, but that's one of the words or ideas that he repeats a lot through many years. So I'm saying, yep, I'm voting it as the number one word that he's using. And then I'm making great significance out of the fact it comes from the center of Finning's Wake. There it is, discarnate. Now, has anybody ever told you that discarnate's in Finning's Wake? No. No one's ever noticed it. In the McLuhan industry, right?
Yeah, I don't know of any discussion about it.
Nothing. And it's an important word. And the placing of it in the book is incredible. It's right beside the chart, the diagram. Same position on the page beside it. So do you have a copy of Finnegan's Wake?
Not here.
Not there.
I mean, I have it in the house somewhere, sure.
Somewhere. Okay, so anyways, I wanted to tell you my big breakthrough. So I told you, and we'll go back. I just read the word discarnate in somewheres in here of what I was just reading, right? I thought I saw that. That's what reminded me. So then I say, I told you that the medieval environment was balanced. There it is. You don't notice you've been discarnate and all over the world on your telephone. I told you that the medieval environment was balanced. You have a little bit of visual space, the phonetic alphabet, and manuscripts, which were balanced off by the oral tactile culture. There was balance in different phases. The balance here is, once you see there are satellite environments balancing off first nature, or first nature is bouncing off second nature, then you can see there's a connubial bliss as the hidden ground. McLuhan had a vision. He saw the new order, and nobody else could see it. They ran around panicking, or schizoid, or hysterical, or ecstatic, or paranoid, because they couldn't see the order beneath everything. He could. He called it a connubium of a superterrestrial kind. It involves a satellite environment, which is off the planet, and it's a matrix. He was the first to use the matrix idea. Then you go to a quote from Understanding Media. Such a program involves the endowing of each plastic form with a kind of nervous system of its own. There's a strange statement that no one talks about. Such a program involves the endowing of each plastic form with a kind of nervous system of its own. Then I translate that. I'm saying objects are coming alive. Plastic form, if you say the nervous system is some kind of life, it's being invested. It's another way of saying what McLuhan said in the first two quotations above. Then you have this really great quote from 1970. At electric speeds, the hieroglyphs of the page of nature become readily intelligible, and the book of the world becomes a kind of Orphic hymn of revelation. What do you think of that one? That's one of his best sentences.
Uh-huh. No, I like that. I like that.
Yeah.
I think it's important to see that McLuhan, from very early on, had the idea that the great problem of the modern world was that its constructions, personal and social constructions, were obscuring its ability to receive information. We can put a hyphen in that, information.
Yeah.
And so the need is to not be held by the galaxy, which is our locality, right? The Gutenberg galaxy is this enormous piece of the cosmos to which we belong, but the Gutenberg galaxy is also a way of being a human being. And for McLuhan, the Gutenberg galaxy, in both senses, gets in the way of cosmic information. And the cosmic information is the connubium.
Would that be an Orphic hymn of revelation?
Sure. You can call it that.
Yeah. The hieroglyphs of the page of nature become readily intelligible.
Right.
So that's the old medium.
When McLuhan says something is easy or something is readily intelligible, what he should put in brackets is that it's easy, but it's the hardest thing of all. It's readily intelligible, but nobody knows what's up, you know, including McLuhan.
Yeah.
So that's how readily intelligible it was.
Yeah, and since you don't get it, you start whistling in the dark, and that's an Orphic hymn of revelation. The book of the world becomes a kind of Orphic hymn of revelation. Whistling in the dark. Tune up the acoustic. So what would be, you got the page of nature. That's not scripture. That's science. The book of the world, that might sound like secular knowledge, but could that refer to scripture? Book of the world?
Oh, definitely. That's what the Nash thesis is mostly about.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? The idea of the book being, first of all, the book of the world, and how that book of the world is intelligible. And so the trivium is three different ways of reading that book.
Yeah. So then it becomes...
So it's a very old theme in McLuhan's work.
Right. And Orphic is Gnostic. He's talking about why a bias towards Gnostic ideologies take over, because it's a fill-in from the electric connubium. So you have an Orphic hymn of revelation. So much of the population is getting insights. And, you know, business would come along and market them through magazines, or now it's different blog sites. The revelation is the...
Bob?
Yes?
Oh, okay. Well, you were, I couldn't hear anything for 20 seconds or something. I thought we'd lost our connection.
All right, so I'll repeat what I said. The Orphic is Gnostic. Gnostic religion, ideology, way back there, 2,000 years ago. So, McLuhan, if you want to cite the Catholics' argument with the Gnostics, then you say, oh, okay, McLuhan is not too impressed with the hymn of Revelation, because it's an Orphic hymn of Revelation. But aside from whether he valued it or not, there was the fact that people were stoned on insights. And more as the media developed into the digital area, the population is addicted to insights or revelation. There's all kinds of bit pieces of revelation going on, little snippets of pattern recognition, which, you know, he said in 1974, we're now addicted to pattern recognition, the cognitive thrills. He's not celebrating something when he says an Orphic hymn of revelation. He's calling the symptoms of disease. So then the book of the world becomes that. So that would be the body of the Christ becoming an ethereal antichrist. What? The book of the world becomes a kind of Orphic hymn of revelation. If you're a Catholic and don't like the Orphic idea, you know?
Mm-hmm. But look, we should just pay some attention, some close attention to the phrase, the Orphic hymn of Revelation. We need to ask, is that an objective genitive or a subjective genitive? Or is it both together? So an objective genitive, Orphic hymn of what? An Orphic hymn of Revelation. So as an objective genitive, that says that the Orphics construct revelation in their hymn. And, of course, McLuhan would reject that.
Yeah.
But only on that first level. If we then go on to say, well, what is Orphic hymn of revelation as a subjective genitive, then that's where the hymn belongs to the revelation. So then, if we say, well, if the hymn belongs to the revelation, then although the first sense of the hymn constructing revelation is short-sighted and wrong, if the hymn belongs, first of all, to the revelation, then even in its being wrong, even in its being a misguided construction, there's something there that is revealed. There is something there that is revelation.
Mm.
So the whole idea that you've been talking about of getting the sense of the world depends upon the idea that all things, as Joyce says in Ulysses, for example, all things manifest intelligibility, not just smart things, not just bright things, all things manifest intelligibility. And so the Orphic hymn of revelation, as long as the of is understood in different ways, you get the complexity of what McLuhan was talking about.
Exactly. So what do I say next? See, how do I explain that? I say the page of nature is science, and the book of the world is all knowledge, all environments. Now, we were just saying now the book of the world was scripture. But anyways, back then I'm saying it's pagan knowledge. That's what McLuhan does. He updates the book of the world. He's not stuck on the page of scientific nature, which is a subset of the printing press, and the book of the world becomes a kind of Orphic hymn of revelation. Science becomes readily x-rayed, and we see the faults in science. It's intelligible. It no longer hypnotizes us. But meanwhile, the multi-global theater android meme is an Orphic hymn of revelation that's stunning you. That's where I got Orphic Baroque spirals from my tiny note chart. Orphism was a mystical Gnostic religion back in the Hellenic Greek days, before Jesus Christ. The next statement below is very important. This is the solution. do we want to retrieve national governments, national economies, or do we want to move to a global international order? No. Where are we to go then? So then McLuhan says on page 227 of Take Today in 1972, the future of government lies in the area of psychic ecology and can no longer be considered on a merely national or international basis. There's a statement that should be plastered everywhere. The future of government lies in the area of psychic ecology. Now, that can be an awareness of the Orphic Hymn of Revelation.
Definitely.
That's the psychic ecology. It can no longer be centered on a merely national or international basis. And, you know, that is the old battle scene. Mm-hmm. The Make America Great Again versus the globalists. Right? There it is.
Wow. Okay, well, you're saying that what we're going to try to do is get beyond that either or that you were just mentioning.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're both entirely wrong.
Right.
But their fallacy has a revelation to it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an Orphic Hymn of Revelation. That's right. You see, the average somnambulist does respond to it and gets all excited. Now they've supposedly divided up America over it. They're so intense about this Orphic Hymn of Revelation. The revelations are happening on both sides. People are, you know, the young kids, the woke kids, I think their vision is, Jesus, what are we fighting about? We're all in the same boat technologically, so why don't we all just get together? Put Bernie Sanders in. Is that his name? No, Bernie. Bernie Sanders.
Bernie,
put
yeah.
Bernie Sanders in. And, well, we'll call it socialism, but it'll just be all togetherness. You can see that since the baby boomers, each generation has been coming up with some ideology of togetherness. Now it's woke.
Mm-hmm.
It's include everybody and then make up all these subdivisions and include them, too.
That idea of we're all in the boat together and we'll include everybody. Well, everybody that agrees with us.
Yeah.
If you don't agree with us, right, and especially if you're historical tradition or something, no, that's not in the boat anymore. We're going to get rid of that.
Yeah, because the idea of including everybody has become a fanatic angular perspective, a specialist
view. Including everybody like me.
Yeah, because we all think. Now, you can see that everybody thinks they're all the same as everybody else because they're all discarnate. Can't visualize it, but everybody's in the same boat of the resonant note of discarnateness. And so let's coagulate around that. And that might be what he's wrestling with in the Digital Communion book. He's kind of wrestling with this point that everybody's in the resonant node. Where can we get faith or spiritual sustenance from that condition? So the millennials said, it's here. Stop resisting it. They didn't know that you could include resistance. The resistance could have a big audience too, or delegation, a constituency. Did you get that? Resistance has a
big. Yeah, I'm not sure how you're using the word resistance, but it's certainly
anti. We're all in the same boat.
Oh, I see. Yeah, of course. I mean. If we're all in the same boat as taken, in the World Economic Forum sense, then there's huge opposition to it, and there should be. We're all in the same boat together, in McLuhan's sense, goes to the cosmos, goes to beyond the galaxy. And there, we're all in the same boat, in the sense that we have lost the thread of our tie to origins and to final ends. And until we refind that sense, then there's just going to be chaos and confusion, which is where we are.
Yeah, and that'll give us a rapid succession of innovations as ersatz anti-environments, or rapid succession of solutions as ersatz anti-environments.
Yeah.
So then I go, and we come back to this, the Jungian point. People think their heads have an unconscious in them, in their skulls, but the environment is the unconscious. And McLuhan's talking about it in the previous quotation 4 years later, 1973, still trying to get people to understand him. He's saying, quote, "The media are what you're not conscious of. That's the avant-garde. News is an anti-environment. People would look at news to ignore the good news of ads. They would get some dose of bad news that they're surviving. The news was an environment and an anti-environment. But all anti-environments by 69 were fake anti-environments because nothing could be an anti-environment to the ongoing Niagara Falls of whatever the heck we were living in. Ersatz anti-environments is the first time fake news is being said." And McLuhan was on TV in 69, the time he was putting this out, saying all news is fake news. And the journalists couldn't take it. That was Warner Troyer.
The journalist, what page are you on now?
102.
Oh, you went back then. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just scrolling down. So Warner Troyer argued with McLuhan. All news is not fake news. I have here the journalist started rudely arguing with McLuhan right there on the TV show. McLuhan is being stubborn. He's saying, "No, you're wrong." The journalist responds, "No, I'm not." It ended up like that. The journalist says, "No, you're wrong." And McLuhan retorts, "No, you're wrong." And that's how the show ended. That's probably McLuhan's worst on the normal intellectual decorum. That was his worst performance. Just a, "No, you're wrong." He's been reduced to street level.
Well, he was upset at the guy's obtuseness.
Yeah.
Instead of the guy acting as a interviewer, he was acting as an umpire.
Yeah. And McLuhan wasn't having it. And so Mr. Troyer died shortly after. Warner Troyer, T-R-O-Y-E-R, if you want to look him up.
Mm-hmm.
So then and we go... Go ahead.
And McLuhan died shortly thereafter.
No, this is 69. He's not going to die for another...
Oh, I thought it was... I'm sorry. I thought it was 77.
No, it's 69.
Okay, so I was wrong.
Yeah, let me see. When did Troyer die? Did he die before McLuhan?
If he did, he died as a young man.
Well, he died in 91, so he did outlive McLuhan.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But maybe he was sick for 10 years. Let's see. Was he sick? Yeah. He contracted throat cancer, and he died in Toronto at age 59. He died younger than McLuhan.
Yeah, and look at the symbolism of throat cancer for an interviewer.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so... he was involved in a program called Eye to Eye. That's not cool. Okay, so that's Mr. Troyer. Died early, 59. So then we have this interesting quote, back to Jung, by Frank Zingroni in The Essential McLuhan, a collection of McLuhan highlights that he and Eric put out in 1995.
But aren't we going backwards here? Didn't we? I thought we were up around 109 or something like that, and all of a sudden we were back on 102. How did that come about?
Well, we were on 103. That's where we were supposed to start, and we start there, but somehow we slipped back, and I didn't notice it. I was intrigued by the quotes. So, anyways, we went over these quotes.
I'm not making a protest here. I was just interested in
how he got here,
how the path led that way.
Well, we got down to the living organisms, the Matrix, Space Odyssey, the Canubium, That's 105. The biology. Wow.
And we were almost at the end of the chapter. We got into 106. Such a program involves endowing of each plastic form with a kind of nervous system. So we were up around 106, 107, near the end of the chapter, and then all of a sudden we got back to 102.
Yeah, how did I, well, something attracted me back there that I thought was relevant. Let's see, 102. I can't even find where we did get to. Anyways, I get bounced back. Oh, I was going into you're wrong. So, I don't know. I lost my bearings. So, back to...
That's a way to figure stuff out, Bob. That's the way to figure stuff out. If you just inquire... in the context of your bearings, you're never going to get anywhere.
Right. So we're coming up to what you were interested in, 109, the global membrane, or Android meme phase one. Finally, we get to the Android meme. So I'm going to go back up here, 108. What is the quote on 108? 107.
Yeah, there is no quote on 108, so 107. But that was before you got back to 102. The future of government lies in the area of psychic ecology.
That's what I bounced from. I bounced back from there.
Exactly.
And so I'm saying one is running around in a chemical body trying to figure out whether to have a world government or Black Lives Matter reparations. All these chemical body issues, none of it is relevant. One has got to deal with one's psychic ecology of balancing our six bodies. As a matter of fact, it's more than psychic ecology. So that's where we've jumped into Bob stuff. It's beyond McLuhan. But that's on my route to the tech body, which is the real goal of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I say, McLuhan knew that government could not happen on a merely national, international basis. Both the international globalists and the nationalists were incompetent. So we said all that.
Yeah. And that's why when McLuhan says that government cannot be merely national or international, he's saying it can't be a matter of space.
Right.
That's the way he puts it in other contexts. So what does that mean? It can't be a matter of space. It means that if we are genuinely to begin to understand one another, we have to begin to understand what understanding is. And understanding is psychic ecology.
Yes.
So the McLuhan often talked about his work as a strategy for survival. And what he was saying is, unless we can understand the new field of psychic ecology.
Which would be your interior landscape.
Correct, the interior landscape. Then we are condemned not to understand each other, not to be able to enter into dialogue, not to be able to have peace. And in a world with nuclear weapons, not to have peace is a very, very dangerous thing.
Yeah, so the McLuhan complained in the 60s about the journalists, cobbling together a newspaper copy, and using the categories left-right for quick summation of the news environment or to lay out the battle lines. Now, 60 years later, it's not left versus right. It's nationalists versus globalists. So those
sure,
are the
but
two
it's
terms.
Also liberal versus conservative in the United States being a big deal, and that's basically left and right.
Yes, but so liberal is globalist. Conservative is nationalist. And so it's the same thing, but the change in terms is due to the discarnate effect. People are not limited to chemical body situations. They'll use it to make cultural wealth and argue over race, class, gender, and all that. But the real battle on the political level, which I like to claim is important, is between the New World Order and those that resist it. And there's different levels of sophistication of resistance, or different interpretations of what you're up against. You know, some of the anti-globalists will say that there's weather warfare going on, that there's major subliminal mind control going on, the use of doubles and all kinds of stuff like that. That would
be biological warfare going on.
What'd you say, biological?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that would be the Alex Jones level. And then you have, I guess, the internationalists would be the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, and all those reasonable liberals who think Trump is a maniac. You know, they're the they tend to a global economy of jobs that come out of the digital education, whatever, however you far you get in your digital university education, you get that degree, and then you might be a candidate for some servo mechanism in the digital onslaught, the Niagara Falls. And people put up with that because they have a lot of chemical body freedoms that they can celebrate and can be distracting and eroding. You know that, right? The chemical body issues, pro and con, pleasurable or painful, are the content that makes the wealth in the Android meme or the global membrane. That's the content.
Well, I think that's what we're going to be discussing in the next chapter.
Yeah.
I would say that we're at the level we're at now, the only conclusion that one can come to is that all of this talk about national, international, left, right, liberal, conservative, is just a mishmash that has no intelligibility to it. So, for example, you said conservatives are national and liberals are international. But there's a huge amount of conservatism in America that is intensely international.
Yeah, corporate.
That wants to take over the world, basically.
Yeah.
Believes it has a claim on the world. And that's called conservatism somehow.
Or neoconservatism.
Neocon.
Yeah.
So the one of McLuhan's just complaints is that we don't know what's going on in that kind of language, and the need for a psychic ecology is precisely to make some sense of this Niagara Falls of information.
Yeah, I'm thinking that since we went through Global Village and then Global Theater, now we've got the Android meme or Global Membrane, that another dialectic is the Global Village people versus the Global Theater. The Global Theater are the digital sophisticates, the millennials who think they understand digital technology and have no qualms of conscience about manipulating the audience about whatever new things they're advocating, whereas the Global Village guys are sort of still nostalgic for their chemical body and for a collection of nations in the global village, which eroding to a global village with less nationalism. The right wingers, the Trumpers, the neocons might be they can accept that, but the put on level, the entertainment level, the media pranks level, the manipulation level, it would be in the realm of the global theater. And those are the sophisticates.
For me, these are all, simultaneous possibilities of understanding the world, and none of them make sense.
Not unless you include the psychic ecology that McLuhan's talking about. So
yeah, psychic ecology can't be included. Psychic ecology is the context itself.
Yeah.
Psychic ecology is the play of art forms, like we were talking about
at
a couple hours ago.
Yeah. So I have here, then when the global theater flipped into the digital global membrane slash Android meme, Finnegan's Wake was there to mirror precisely the chaosmos, which is on page 118 of Finnegan's Wake, and to mirror precisely the chaosmos and intimacy of Web 2.0. That's what I end with. And then you go into section 3. So it took half the book to get here.
Yeah.
Okay. So
it took us 52 episodes going back and forth to get to this point.
That's about 200 hours almost.
Yeah.
So I'm just going back. Plastic form. I did cover all the quotes. I sort of jumped around and did the wrong. We even got down to Orphic Hymn. So that's it. We went through the content, and I didn't want to stay too long on any point, but we really had to get into explaining the Canubium. You even started to have to write some columns on it. So now I think we're into a new level of what the heck is Bob trying to talk about. And I'm still trying to drag McLuhan along. Give him credit for being in the game still. You know what I mean?
Well, that's good of you, Bob.
Yes, I'm going to try to find quotes.
Magnanimous
of me, yes. Considering I'm going to slay him later, then I don't tell him where I'm dragging him to.
Well, we shall see.
Yeah. But they won't notice that. They'll just think, oh, yeah, another McLuhanite. Loses his bearings. Will be what the reviewers say. So I think that's it. We got another session.
Well, it's a good place to break.
Yes.
We're about ready to get into a whole new phase.
Yep. And
that's what you call it, phase one.
Yeah, this is the Android meme phase one. There's two phases of Android meme. So... Remember, we are being hoiked up as a role model of intelligent dialogue, of reasonable dialogue, which the world has lost sight of.
Right. Well, there's certain humor to that, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Good.
Great talking to you. We'll talk soon.
All right, Bob. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye. Cameron. Bye.